This is Lara Newton, and this was March 13th, 2009, a talk entitled Brothers and Sisters, Discovering the Psychology of Companionship. This was recorded on a DVD, and there were a few slides on the DVD. It's in the library at the Seattle Jung Society.
Hello, everyone, and welcome. I'm Ginny Mines, and it's my pleasure to introduce our speaker tonight, Lara Newton. Lara is a senior diplomat Jungian analyst with a private practice in Denver, Colorado. She's been a therapist since 1982. She's currently the coordinator of admissions and the co-coordinator of training at the C.G. Jung Institute of Colorado. She's vice president of that organization, and she has been the president of the Jung Society of Colorado for over 10 years. Tonight, she's going to be talking about Brothers and Sisters, the title of her first book, Discovering the Psychology of Companionship. This isn't a topic that's been written about, so she is a pioneer in this area. She's charting new territory. She says, the brother-sister relationship is not only psychologically alive for many individuals, but it also provides us with hope for our world. Brother and sister point the way toward a new understanding of companionship and mutuality because, first and foremost, they are companions. The coming together of opposites and companionship is an experience of profound meaning. This is a power that unites us to ourselves and to others. It is a creative and life-generating force. At this point in history, we must remember that there is power not only in conflict and discord, but also in harmony and equanimity. So please join me in welcoming Lara Newton.
Well, I'm going to start with something that I hope will tie in my theme to the general experience of Jungian psychology. And so right at first, you won't hear me talking about brothers and sisters, but don't worry, you're at the right lecture. I think that many of us, and many people that we know, had an oddly familiar kind of experience when we first learned about Jungian psychology. It's an experience that some people refer to as something like finding home, or finding a familiar place that we knew might exist, but we had maybe begun to despair of ever finding. It's like seeing pieces of our life's puzzle come together, maybe for the first time, at least for the first time outside of our own interior lives. What does that experience, which is really very deeply personal and also very common, and we could say universal, among us, what does it signify? I'll suggest that in that moment when the sense of having found home occurs, the individual has experienced the awakening of the mythic quality of life. Perhaps we've stumbled upon a part of what Jung called the individual myth. So I've stumbled upon something that connects me externally to this, or connects my inner life to this external experience, and it's an awakening to my individual myth. It's a very personal experience, and it links me to humankind in an uncanny way. This is a picture of my brother and me. I was 2 and he was 4. When I was a very young child, my mother read to my brother and me fairy tales and myths. I was drawn to the stories about brothers and sisters, among others. Hansel and Gretel, alone in the woods, needing to find a way through on their own. The Children of Lear, a tragic story in which a sister and her brothers are transformed into swans and separated from the family and from all human life. Other grim stories, like the 12 brothers, in which sisters and brothers are separated from each other at an early stage, enchanted, eventually find meaning in restoring their union and coming back together, restoring their union, and sometimes transforming back into the human experience because they've been transformed into various forms, animal forms, during the story. My childhood dreams also emphasized that relationship, the importance of the brother-sister connection. The first long dream that I remember was a dream when I was 5 years old, in which my brother and I went through a very fairy tale-like experience, ourselves being transformed into swans. Then when I was in my early 20s, I had a dream. It wasn't that unusual at that point for me to have dreams about my brother. But I had a dream that felt powerful to me. In the dream, my brother and I were battling a dark and powerful enemy. Together, we managed to gather a small band of people who were opposed to this enemy. But we weren't strong enough, and the enemy was ready to overtake us at close to the end of the dream. And then we saw an image that meant help was on the way for us. That image in my dream was an image of Jesus in a sort of resurrection type of mode. So my brother and I recognized help was on the way. That was the end of the dream. Now, in just a bit, I'll talk about why that particular image is important. I wasn't really religious at the time. I didn't really even feel that the dream was a religious dream. I remember at a certain point, probably a couple of years after I'd had the dream, having people say to me, "Well, did you think you needed that you had lost your faith, that you needed to go back to Christianity?" It never occurred to me when I had that dream. I had a feeling that there was something powerful, that there was something meaningful going on, that a feeling of being lost that had sort of persisted in my life for a while at that point might be about to change. But I didn't really have words for what I felt. It wasn't a religious conversion. It was another kind of conversion. Now, about a week or so, it might have been 10 days, after I had that dream, the new semester began. I was a senior at that point in college, and I was taking an honors class in philosophy and literature. I walked into the class, and I met my first Jungian analyst. She was a philosophy professor at this school, and she basically came into the class and said, "We're going to do a Jungian approach to interpreting literature." And she proceeded to tell us what that meant and to talk to us about dreams. And at the end of that class, I went up to her and I told her that I had a dream I wanted to talk to her about. And within about a year, I was in analysis with her and had decided that I would train to become a Jungian analyst. I was 23. It was a long journey, but that was the beginning of a major transition in my life. You could say I had found home. And somehow, mysteriously, my relationship with my brother was caught up in this. I knew from a very early point in my interest in Jungian psychology that I would, not only in my own analysis, but that somehow in some other way, like writing a book, I would be exploring this relationship and working with it for some time. Let's see if I can get another image here. Okay. Can you all read that? Was that a yes? A little bit of murmuring. Okay, well, the problem here is that I don't have it in front of me. I usually have the computer right in front of me. So let me get my own images. Okay, well, the pictures on the right side are pictures from an alchemical text that the reference doesn't show up at the bottom there. There are three plates. They're not in a row. They are plates number 2, 13, and 20 in the Rosarium Philosophorum. I never know if I'm pronouncing that right, but it's a series of alchemical plates that depict one version of the transformation from an unconscious state to a consciously realized state of union of the opposites. Jung uses this particular series, he doesn't actually use plate 20, but he uses this series in his essay on the psychology of the transference. So any of you who are serious students of Jung and have read that, you might recognize at least these first two plates here because they're used in that essay. I'm showing them here because they are examples of some aspects of the archetypal qualities of the brother-sister bond, the brother-sister dynamic, the brother-sister relationship. So the words that I have over on the side are really just touch points for you to give an idea of some of the aspects of what that archetypal image is about. So for me, and sort of related to what Jenny read at the very beginning from my book, for me, as I did the research on brother-sister images in literature, I really started feeling that the word that best depicts what the brother-sister relationship is about is companionship. I have a lot of reasons that I have delineated for that. First, it just sort of came to me. Brother and sister are companions. They're not. It's not a father-daughter relationship. It's not one in which authority rules. It's not a lover relationship, although love is certainly an important factor. It's a relationship in which a kind of equality is worked out. And so let me just say at this sort of insert at this point that tonight I will talk a little bit about difficult relationships, difficult brother-sister relationships. But what I'm focusing on for the purposes of this lecture is the archetypal pattern of union between the opposites that brother-sister uniquely can give us. That archetypal pattern is a very hopeful pattern. It has a lot to do with cooperation, companionship, mutual authority, harmony, equality, and those words may not be words that you would necessarily associate with your own relationships with your siblings. So sometimes you'll just have to suspend, what is it, the suspension of disbelief? you'll have to suspend that personal experience, we all do, in order to come to an understanding of what the archetypal whole meaning is. Within that archetype are a lot of experiences of disharmony, a lot of experiences in which mutuality does not seem to be prominent. That's the nature of the archetype, but the potential for wholeness and for companionship is what I'll be focusing on tonight mainly. Now, so I want to make sure I cover all of the things that are written here. So companionship, the royal couple is an alchemical term. These two figures in the plate two are a king and queen. They are Sol and Luna. Sol is the man, and he's standing on an image of the sun. And Luna is his sister, and she's standing on an image of a crescent moon. at a certain point in his writing on alchemy, and it might have been in the essay in which he uses this image, I'm not absolutely sure. Jung says that brother and sister stand allegorically for the whole experience of the opposites. It's a pretty strong statement about what that particular image, that particular archetypal relationship of brother and sister mean. Jung never really went into any kind of work with the brother-sister image that would take it from the archetypal realm into the more human, personal realm. Not in his writing, he didn't. So, and really no other Jungians have done much. There's been an essay here and there, some nice essays, but very short, dealing with one or another aspect of brother and sister. And what I've done is really pull together the little bit of Jungian information and a lot of basic work with fairy tales and myths and dreams of clients and friends and my own dreams and just sort of historical work. Now it's historical work with brother-sister relationships in the world. Now, besides talking about stories, my own personal stories, and touching on fairy tales, here's what I'm going to want to impress upon you tonight. The idea of the brother-sister pair as an archetypal image, and what that really means, what that gives us that's unique. And the psychological experience that's activated by that relationship. I have an image that I'll go to in just a minute. Now, the psychological experience of transformation of the relationship is something that I'm going to talk about tonight. And the process of transformation goes through essentially three stages. The first stage is an experience of the bond in an external relationship and an intrapsychic experience. The bond is essentially a state like participation mystique. Do you know that term? It's an unconscious union, so that for a brother and a sister who are in this state of participation mystique, whether it's a positive relationship or a negatively experienced relationship, there's a lot of projection going on. There's a lot of he's living out certain qualities for me, I'm living out certain qualities for him. We're not conscious of what we're of what the relationship is that we're in, of what we're doing for each other, and of what the relationship is itself. It's when we're speaking developmentally, it's the relationship of a brother and sister as children. And that is the stage in which the brother or the sister complex will be formed. That complex is basically an expression of the unconsciousness of the union. Okay, so the bond is the first stage. The second stage is the wounding stage. Now, this is a wound to the relationship. If the relationship has been a negative one, the wounding stage can feel liberating and positive. If it's been a very positive, symbiotic kind of relationship, the wounding stage may be experienced as painful initially, although usually at the wounding stage, which comes around adolescence, one or the other of the brother and sister are itching to get out into the world and have relationships and life outside of the family. So the wound may not be experienced as painful to both. It may not even be experienced as painful right away, but sometime during the wounding stage, we begin to experience the pain of the separation. And then the third stage is a stage of healing and redemption, in which there's a lot of stuff that goes on during these stages, and I'm running through them real quickly, and then I'll come back to them. But in the healing and redemption stage, essentially, the brother or the sister has come to a psychological maturity in which that intrapsychic brother-sister unity can be experienced. So the healing may or may not be a healing of the outer relationship. Often there is some coming together that happens for the actual figures in that relationship. Not always. It's really an intrapsychic process that we're talking about by that time. Now, going back to the idea of the archetypal relationship, I want to stress to you, well, first of all, I'm very aware that there are so many symbols of the self that we know about, hear about. Some are inanimate objects, some are living energies. But the brother-sister relationship is one such image. It is an image of the self. The self, defined by me using Jung's concept, is essentially the source and the true center of the individual personality. When we feel a connection to the self, when we feel the presence of the self, there's a sense of oneness or a feeling of wholeness that comes along with that experience. So that's what I mean when I say the brother-sister relationship is an image of the self. It's an archetypal image. It stands for the self. And one of the features, one of the sort of unique features of the brother-sister relationship, something that it gives us a sense of in terms of this quest for an understanding of what the self is in our lives. So the brother and sister is a relational experience of the self. Essentially, it's an image of relationship. Whether external or internal, it's always about relationship, the brother-sister dynamic is. The two, brother and sister, function as two sides or aspects of one thing. Two sides or aspects of a unity and a oneness. If one side, and this happens in actual relationships and it happens in fairy tale images a lot, if one side, the brother or the sister, begins to tend towards a narrow focus, too one-sided way of being. The other comes in and corrects that experience, sort of reels, the sister reels the brother in, or the brother realigns the sister. Through observing this relational quality, we can come to see something about the behavior of the self. And so these are unique qualities that the brother-sister dynamic has that some other images of the self don't have. The relational quality, the interaction between the two sides of this self-experience, and the experience of a sort of behavioral quality to the self. The pair, as self-image, bring to the individual a sense of something that I talk about quite a bit in my book. This is an expression that I think is really significant and central to the brother-sister experience. And it's a sense of faith in one's own life. Now that sounds a little bit simple. But it's something that we don't often get. We, no matter how good a mother is, no matter how good a father is, they may give us a sense of faith in life. They may give us a sense of faith in what's come before us, but they can't give us that sense of faith in right now, right here, who I am, my generation, because they are authorities. They're in a different generation. A relationship between siblings, and this actually is true for siblings, period, that the brother-sister kind of dynamic gets going. It's just much more prominent between siblings of the opposite sex. This sense of faith in one's own individual life is something that comes within a family system through the relationships among the siblings. If we don't get that sense, if we don't have siblings, we seek relationships with peers in which the peer feels like a brother or feels like a sister. We seek it unconsciously. If we have a bad relationship with our siblings and we're not getting that sense of faith in our lives, by the time we're adolescents, we find somebody. It's an archetype. It's an archetypal experience. We need that kind of connection in order to move forward in our lives and have a sense that we matter, that this generation matters, this life matters. Brother-sister dynamic is something that gives us that. Faith. Maybe I already said this, I'm not sure. But I have one more little sentence written on this page. Why faith in one's own life? So the essential equality of the opposites that brother and sister manifest allows for a development of the sense of one's own life as being self-directed. And that, again, I'm talking about self-direction as not really opposed to, but as compared to the kind of direction that we get from elders, the kind of direction we get from parents, grandparents, teachers, mentors who are of that other generation. Those are important aspects to our development, but they don't give us this particular kind of connection that the brother-sister relationship does give us. And this isn't in my notes, so I don't want to digress too much, but brother and sister, even though there's definitely love as a psychological experience is an aspect of that relationship that's important. The archetype of brother and sister, the relationship is not a relationship of lovers per se. The relationship with the lover that also, well, it's related to the brother-sister connection, because often the first love relationship outside the family is a relationship that pulls brother and sister apart, pulls them away from each other. It's one of the main ways in which the wound occurs for a sort of normally, healthily developing brother and sister relationship. One or the other of the brother or sister falls in love with someone and suddenly is no longer available for the sibling relationship. And that experience is another development. It's a very important psychological development, but it differs from the kind of love that's experienced between brother and sister. And if it doesn't, if the brother and sister relationship becomes an incestuous relationship, there's a sort of psychological incest that naturally exists with siblings. But if it becomes an unhealthily incestuous relationship, then that other aspect of the development is harmed, is wounded. So the wound to the brother-sister relationship must occur in order for normal, healthy development to take place for the two individuals, even though it's a painful wound, and a coming back to that dynamic, to that relationship is important. The wound must occur. Okay. I haven't gone beyond this one page. Let's see what's next. Oh, yes. Okay. I have a few images here. I'll just talk about these images for a minute. Now, can I go back and forth between these two?
Yes, the backspace key.
The backspace key. Okay. Okay, so there's. I'll talk about this one first. I'm afraid of that backspace key. This is a painting of Apollo and Artemis. And they're in battle, I think with the Maenads. And I use this image and the next image, which is of a different brother and sister pair, just to give a sort of visual sense of the equality aspect. And what's nice is with both of these two pictures, that the brother and sister actually have a very similar stance. Here, they're both in battle. They've got the same weapon. They're facing the same enemy. They're both in this sort of upright position. Here, the brother's in front, but you don't really get a sense of him leading her. You just get a sense of the two of them being in battle. So this is a really nice image of the equality between brother and sister. Apollo and Artemis actually are often used as examples of the absolute harmony, the potential for absolute harmony between brother and sister. He rules the day, she rules the night. They have this flow to their relationship. Okay, I might not need to go back to that. This one is just a little bit harder to see. Didn't come out as good an image, but this is from, let's see if I've got my title. That's an Indian brother and sister. It's from a fairy tale collection of American Indian stories, and the book was titled Red Indian Stories. I don't even think we'd be able to, it's an old book from the 1950s. I don't think we'd be able to publish a book with that title these days. But this story is also a story of a brother and sister, and if you can tell, the sister is the one in front. There's a wolf who's a companion of theirs. There are animals all around here. And the bear is confronting the brother and sister. They're both standing with their arms up. The sister's in front. Again, you don't particularly get a sense of the sister leading. You get a sense of equality. Okay. So I, you know, I could go on and on with images like this, images that just visually depict the kind of idea of this archetypal presence. But I won't go on and on. Let's see. So this is, these are just some really brief descriptions. And I don't, actually I probably do have that page here. These are descriptions of the three stages. Now I want to talk about the three stages, and I also have some images from fairy tales of these three stages. But first I'll just talk about the words that are here, and then I'll kind of go into a little bit more of a description of each stage. So the stage of bonding, I've already mentioned it to you. It's the stage in which the brother or sister complex gets formed. If the brother-sister relationship is a positive one, and that's pretty much the model that we're going to talk about mostly tonight, it's a stage in which the two figures have this powerful closeness. There's a feeling of equality. There's a feeling of protection also, in which sometimes the sister protects the brother, sometimes the brother protects the sister. They always sort of have each other's back. There's a sense that they're really in this life experience together. This "we're in this together" is one of the quotes I have here. And the bond is the place where that faith in one's own life, even though it's a sort of unconscious experience, as faith is in the beginning, that experience is born in that early relationship. Now, I have, my own personal experience was a positive bond with my brother. We were 2 years apart. We grew up together. My two children are 7.5 years apart, and the bond between them began before my daughter was born. My son wanted a sister. I had divorced his father. I said, "No, it's not going to happen. You're not going to have, I'm sorry, you're not going to have a sister." Years later, he got his sister. But he already had an idealized sister in his head, and she immediately took on that projection. He was a second grader. He was not supposed to care about his sibling. Also, my brother, who was 2 years old, was not supposed to care about his sibling. These were developmentally not the right ages to introduce the sibling. And both of these relationships were immediately powerful relationships. The developmental information does give us guidelines, but it doesn't control the psyche. These powerful relationships occur. And my sense is that my son was already, this also is not in the notes, so I better be careful, that my son was already, before his sister was born, finding sister-like relationships out in the world. He wanted a sister. He had this image of a girl who would be a companion to him. And even though he had relationships with boys, he would, every year, and this was schools where kids would come and go, and it, not the kind of life I had where, you know, you're in a school and everybody moves to the next grade together. But he would always find a girl who would be as close a companion to him as any boys that he was playing with. He just had this, this dynamic was central in his life. So, the bonding stage, let's see. I'm not going to try to use the backspace. So then the wounding stage is the stage in which one of the things I say here is, I think I said it here, the outside world comes in, yeah. So sometimes, and you see this in happening in fairy tales often, the fairy tale that I used sort of centrally in the sister's work section of the book is a Grimm's fairy tale called Brother and Sister. And in that story, the sister and brother are, when the wounding stage begins, they are in a little hut in the woods, away from any other life. The brother has been transformed into a roebuck, and that's where they live. And the sister keeps the door locked. And a king and his huntsman come into the woods and begin a hunt. And the brother wants to go out and be hunted. He wants to go out and join this hunt as a roebuck. And the sister says, okay, but I'm going to keep the door locked, and you have to come and say these words to me to come back in. And somehow the king, well, somehow, it happens in the tale, the king figures out a way to get that door open and come into the hut where the daughter, where the sister is. So the idea that the world comes to us if we don't go out into the world is very strong in that wounding stage. We either have the urge to move out of that participation mystique kind of experience that the brother-sister relationship has given us, or the world comes to us and breaks up that world of innocence. So, as I say, there's an enforced or a chosen separation. Sometimes it's a rejection, one or the other, or maybe both siblings around the same time reject the other. It can be, the wound can feel wounding, the wound can feel like a rejection, or it can be almost unconsciously experienced. And what I mean by that is we can... And this is something that more or less happened to me. I'm not certain with my brother. I think it happened to him too. But at a certain point when I was around 15, I kind of realized that my brother and I didn't come home from school and talk to each other for hours like we used to. I don't really know how long that had been going on, but I just kind of realized that we were leading different lives. And when I realized it, I missed it. But this had been a very unconscious wounding stage up to that point. So the wounding experience is the call to individuation. We have to move out of that unconscious state of union, and it's experienced as a wound. The wound to the Uroboric state. Okay, and then the stage of healing and redemption. The brother-sister relationship becomes an inner reality. Now, I mentioned enchantment. I mentioned it earlier, I think. Yeah, I mentioned it under the wounding stage. I won't go into that too much because it would take us away from this focus. But there, in fairy tales, often the brother or the sister, sometimes both, but one or the other, will be put into some state of enchantment, either at the sort of end of the bonding stage, but it goes through the wounding stage, that that figure or both figures are in another animal form. Sister gets turned into a dragon, brother gets turned into a bird, and this... in the story I just mentioned, the brother gets turned into a roebuck. In my dream, when my brother and I were five, we were both turned into swans. And the enchantment serves a sort of purpose, I think. I see it as doing several things all at the same time. But one of the major aspects of its purpose is that the figure who's not transformed. Now, when they are both transformed, that's a unique situation. I'm not going to talk about it right now. But when the figure who's not transformed is the one who's having to do all of the work on the human level. The other figure, and if we think of this as one psyche, the brother and sister as one psyche, you have one figure who's really getting connected in the unconscious to something instinctual, some aspect of our psychological development that needs to be developed, but requires, in order for it to be developed, this extreme situation is required, this enchantment. The enchantment comes as a negative force. It's usually a witch or a magician who enchants that figure, intending for them to die. They don't die, they transform. So at the healing and redemption stage, the one thing that happens is if anyone is still enchanted, they become unenchanted. They become human again. Sometimes they become human again and they marry a figure who's just waiting for them. Sometimes they become human again, the siblings are reunited, but always the reunion is at a more, is at an adult level. If the brother has been enchanted, in some cases the sister has gotten married, has had children during that enchantment, and then the brother comes out of his enchantment and he's ready to live his adult life. And he's in a relationship with his sister too. Some of the developments are parallel. Usually you have to, in the fairy tales, you have to take one fairy tale as depicting a sort of woman's development with that brother as an animus figure, because she's gotten married, she's done all these things that differentiate her life. He just comes out of enchantment and then is able to live his life from that point on. In other stories, it's the sister who has not done all that work, but is now in an adult life and can. So in the healing and redemption stage, the brother-sister relationship, for us humans, non-fairy tale figures, the relationship becomes an inner reality. Enchantment comes to an end. Healing occurs for us on an outer level, maybe, definitely on an inner level. There's a broader sense of one's ability to relate to others as sisters and brothers. One of the things that I've seen in so many people who had a powerful brother-sister relationship at the core of their life experience, some positive, some negative, is that the relationship during these earlier stages of development, the bond and the wounding stages, the relationship either was a real experience against which all other relationships were measured, usually coming up short, or if it was a negative relationship, you see the reverse would be happening there. But the relationship itself is not quite yet internalized enough for that individual to be able to relate as sister or brother to others in his or her life. In the redemption and healing stage, that is happening. The brother-sister dynamic is internalized enough. We have this way of relating to others that has a sister and brother dynamic to it. I'm saying sister and brother because I can say that the sort of dominant way in which I relate to people is as a sister type figure. And that's whether they are men or women. And I certainly know people who are mothers first and foremost, and that's the dynamic that they've learned and transformed and worked with predominantly. Not everyone will have a brother-sister brother-sister dynamic as a sort of central aspect of the relationship. But just as I have, in the course of my development, have needed to come to terms also with mothering and my relationship to that aspect of the psyche, all of us do also have to come to terms with this sibling energy within ourselves and in our outer relationships. Well, let's just see what's next here. An image of the bond. One thing about Hansel and Gretel, It's a story. I don't want to confuse myself. You're all just sort of a blur. I can't switch glasses back and forth. It's a story really that is about the bond. Hansel and Gretel are children at the beginning, they're children at the end. They don't move beyond that first stage, but it's a really good image. The story itself is a really good image of the bonding experience. You have things like, at the beginning of the story, during the first maybe third of the story, Hansel is clearly the leader. He's the one who puts the pebbles on the path as they go into the woods so that they can find their way back home. He's the one who comes up with the second and not so good idea of using breadcrumbs, but he's the leader. Later in the story, when Hansel is in the cage and Gretel is the one who's more or less free in the witch's hut, she's not in a cage anyway, Gretel comes up with a plan. She becomes the leader. And if you remember that story, what she does is she keeps a bone, I think it's a chicken bone, from and she slips it to her brother in the cage, and as the witch is trying to fatten him up, she says, when she says she wants to feel your finger to see if you're gaining weight, stick this little bone out for her, because the witch is very hard, nearsighted. She doesn't have good vision. It's like hard of seeing. Anyway, she's almost blind. And a lot of witches are, can't see very well. So there's a bone, and she thinks that he's not getting fat, so that it gives them time to come up with another plan. It buys them time. So you get a sense there of a sort of smooth transition. It's in the face of adversity, but of course, growing up is an adverse experience, right? So brother and sister are in this together. When authority is needed, one of them comes up with a plan, and it's a very... Within that relationship, it's a smooth transition. Their life isn't smooth, but how they handle it together is very harmoniously. Let's see, I think I've got just another Hansel and Gretel image here. Yeah, this one is a little hard to see, but this is Hansel and Gretel when they're asleep in the woods. Really the beginning of they don't get home after this, and there are angels watching over them. Now this next one I'll just go over real quickly. This is an image for the experience of enchantment. This is I actually have several images from this fairy tale. I just liked the art of this one. This is brother and sister, and in this is the scene when there's a stream right in front of them, and brother has just been transformed into a roebuck. He's actually gone through, he's gone to three streams, and each time the sister, who has a very sort of medial quality in this story, the sister can hear the language of the brooks. There's several times in which she has this ability to commune with nature. She has this ability to read nature. So she hears the brooks telling what he'll be transformed into if he drinks from them, because they've all been enchanted. And the first one is a wolf, the second one is a tiger, and she's saying, you can't drink from that, you'll kill me. And then when he turns into a roebuck, she's afraid that he'll run away from her. But he's just too thirsty, so he has to drink. He transforms into a roebuck, and she makes a leash. She takes her garter, and that becomes his collar. It's golden. And then she makes a leash from reeds, and they stay together that way until they find the hut. Okay. Now, the next images are images of wounding. This is actually a brother-sister relationship that was never good in this fairy tale. This is a tale. This is a tale that any of you who are going to be in the workshop tomorrow, we're going to spend a lot of time with this tale, I think, because it's a really powerful Swahili tale called The One-Handed Girl. And this is the scene in which she's about to lose her hand. It's a very long and complicated tale, so I won't go into a lot of details, but the brother and sister have, you could say, extremely different philosophies of life. They do. They really do. And because of an agreement they made with their parents on their parents' deathbed, the brother has this belief that anything the sister gets, he can come take from her. And she has just been earning her keep by growing pumpkins and selling them. And she's here holding, she's given him some pumpkins. There aren't any ripe ones. He's going to take the unripe pumpkins, and she's holding the vine. And instead of admitting defeat or whatever he would need to do at that point, he cuts off her hand. He doesn't get any pumpkins anyway, but the what happens here, and this is, I think I'm just not going to use my notes at this point. They're a little too distracting. I'm just going to talk about these themes for a while. because this is a good example of the kind of experience that the wound is when the relationship, when the bond has been a negative bond. So this relationship has essentially been abusive, we could say. Yeah, I mean, in modern terms, we could say this has been an abusive relationship. Every time she gets any little life eked out for herself, he comes and takes it from her. And she's been accepting this because of this agreement with the parents, and she's been accepting his interpretation of the agreement. And at the point when he cuts off her hand, she's incredibly wounded. She wraps her arm, she goes into the jungle, and she hides. She hides for some time. And when she comes down with, yeah, I'm not going to go into all the tale again, I'm saying I'm not. When she comes down, she goes to a different little kingdom. She goes to a different village. She doesn't come back ever to this village. But that wound marks a change for her. And the change takes some time to truly develop. But the change is that she no longer feels bound to him. One of the ways of expressing this that I've used sometimes is that the wound to the bond, when the bond has been a dark, negative experience, can be something like the end of denial. Does that make sense? So she's been in a state of denial. She's been, just speaking, again, in modern psychological terms, she's been in this relationship that keeps her from developing at all. And it really keeps both of them from developing. But he definitely has the power over her. And at the point when she loses her hand, she leaves the relationship. She has nothing at that point, except she has the beginning of the seeds of her own individual development. And the tale goes on for some, it's like a 20-page tale. It's maybe not 20, but it's a long tale. And it goes on for some time, and she encounters him again later, but very differently. Okay. Let's see. I have another wound. This is actually a dark comedy, but this is a brother-sister relationship in a Mexican film called Matando Cabos. The brother and all of the siblings, and there are a lot of siblings and there are a lot of cousins in this movie, and they're all after each other all the time. The sister lives, by the way. But they definitely have an antagonistic relationship. And they wound each other. Right now it looks like him who's trying to wound her, but they definitely wound each other. Okay, let's see. I'll mention here I don't want to stick with that image.
Let's see. Okay, I'm going to try the backstage.
This one's not much better, but at least it's not a gun. Just to talk a little bit about this wounding stage a little bit more. Get my other notes just in case there's something juicy that I want to say that I forgot about. I think in general terms that if we're looking at a brother-sister relationship that's developing through life from childhood on, we would say it's around adolescence that the wound occurs. Some individuals don't find the brother or sister figure until around adolescence. When there either has been just very negative sibling relationships. Sometimes it's not just negative relationships, but the parents' intervention has kept siblings from really forming relationships with each other. The relationships are, you know, when there's extreme sibling rivalry, that's basically what's happening. The sibling relationships really go through the authority realm first. It's always sort of like competition for a parental approval, not a direct relationship between the siblings. So sometimes, for one reason or another, an outer relationship doesn't even form with a sibling-like figure, a brother or sister-like figure, until adolescence. and sometimes it's an extension. There is a brother-sister relationship, but that adolescent connection is an extension of the sort of development of being able to have that kind of relationship with others. So I sort of like think back in your life or in the lives of your children or the lives of other people you've known. Either you've experienced this or you know people who've experienced this kind of relationship in which the kinds of things you say are, he's just like a brother to me, or he was just like a brother to me, she's just like a sister to me. What do we mean when we say that? I know that adolescent girls and boys who might be sort of developmentally in that stage where everybody's thinking about romance, everybody's thinking about love relationships, there will be the formation of this relationship with someone you can tell anything to. It's someone of the opposite sex, someone that you have this ability to communicate on a different level than the level that you're communicating with other people. And it's the relationship where you say he's like a brother, she's like a sister. We might not know exactly what that means. But I would say it means that person is like a companion. That person has a soulful connection to me, and it's different from the other things that my soul is seeking at that point, because that is the point when we're looking for love relationships in whatever form. Adolescence is when that is that kind of energy. The seeking of the other is very powerful. And this other energy comes along that's not the love interest. So if there's been a strong relationship with a brother or sister and that relationship is experiencing a wound, we may not seek the confidant, the person who's like the brother or like the sister. But often that is that right at the same time that there's I want to call just basically call it animus and anima development that's screaming to be experienced. Along with the love relationships, there's this other kind of relationship brewing. So there's a wound to the sibling relationship, if there has been a strong one. There also might be a new kind of brother-sister relationship forming in the outer life outside the family. There also might be for the first time the experience of that because there may have not been a sibling. Let me also mention this idea about the wound. I think that the wounding experience can be broken down, all of these stages can be broken down into a lot of sub-stages. But at least there are two pretty powerful aspects to the wound. One aspect is the wound. The wound to a relationship that has heretofore been significant in the individual's life. The other aspect is that the wound itself throws that individual, brother or sister, into a need to develop. So if the sister has a need to develop her own feminine identity. Now, we all have to, when a participation mystique kind of relationship, an unconscious powerful relationship is wounded or is being broken up, we all have to then develop something on our own, some sort of interior experience of ourselves. A sister or a brother who has been symbiotically experiencing this oneness, this wholeness, now is thrown back upon himself or herself and has to develop a sense of individual identity that may have been lacking because of this powerful sibling relationship. That definitely was my experience during my adolescence. There was a lot of needing to find myself separate from my brother because my brother was someone who always gave me a sense of confidence. He would always believe I could do whatever I was needing to do at the time. And when I didn't have that relationship to rely on, I found that I wasn't as confident as I had kind of grown up sort of thinking I was. Suddenly, I realized it wasn't there because he wasn't there, and I had to develop my own sense. That was one of the things that became very clear for me. And I see these sibling relationships, when they have experienced the wound, then the individual is sort of thrust back on himself or herself, needing to develop really a sense of identity so that ultimately a reunion with the brother or sister can happen psychologically. Okay. So in the... Let's skip over here to... I think... Okay. Redemption and healing. I love this picture. This is an image from, it's an English fairy tale. The title of the fairy tale is The Laidly Worm of Spindleston's Hugh. Just rolls right off the tongue, you know. In this fairy tale, the sister, this is the point when the sister has been redeemed. The brother had gone off on a knightly quest, and the sister was enchanted by a stepmother, an evil witch stepmother. The brother finds out, it's a sort of complicated ending. He finds out that the sister is in trouble. He finds out she's been enchanted. He also, you know, fairy tales sort of do this. He also finds out that there's a dragon who's ravaging the countryside. He doesn't put two and two together and say, oh, she's the dragon. So he's coming back to help his sister, redeem his sister, because there's been an oracle that's been consulted, I think is how it works, and they know that the brother is needed in order for the sister to be redeemed. But when he gets to shore, he thinks he has to slay the dragon. And what he ends up having to do, and this is a major, really symbolically speaking, this is a major aspect of what happens when the brother returns to a connection to the inner sister. What he has to do is he has to put down his sword. The dragon tells him this in a little sort of rhyme. He has to put down his sword and he has to kiss the dragon three times. So this is absolutely going against the grain for a hero. The hero slays the dragon. And he's told that the only way he can save his sister, so he sees that this is his sister beneath the dragon's skin, the only way he can save his sister is to go against all of his heroic training, all of his identity as a man in the world, and express his love for his sister when she's not looking like his sister. It's a really powerful psychological experience that the tale is talking about. So the hero returns and expresses, through this simple act, expresses his love for his sister. And this is a picture of her in the middle of her transformation. You see the dragon skin is basically falling off of her, and they're reunited. Now this is the next picture is the last picture. These are my kids. My kids had a complicated, still do, have a complicated story. And I won't go into it, but I have this one short paragraph in my book, which is actually about them. And I'll tell you that I use this picture as an image for the healing redemption stage. This picture was taken on New Year's Day 2 years ago. Yeah, my daughter was 17, and my son was whatever 7.5 added to 17 is. 24, almost 25. And he had been away. Actually, when he became a teenager, when he was sort of like in the middle of his teenage rebellion years, 15, 16, she experienced a powerful wound. He was suddenly not available to her at all. And she was a third grader. And all of her friends had loved her big brother, and there was this sort of, a lot of her identity was about having this big brother, and he was totally not available for her. And we kind of thought we were doing a good job as parents, helping her life move along, and we probably were. But when she hit about the same age that he had been when she was wounded by him, she went into a depression, and just her whole sense of herself seemed to just crumble. And we got her into therapy. I mean, what else do you do? And one of the things that came up in her work with her therapist, and my daughter, by the way, has told me she was happy for me to talk about this to any group, so just so you know that, was that she realized it was the same age. None of us were even thinking of that. It was just, you know, what do we do? How do we help her? That this was the same age that he had been when she had lost him. For a while, she wasn't able to express that to him. And this Christmas season, when he came home and was with us, she did. And they were getting along so well. So she was 17 here, and, you know, it had been a couple of years of therapy and growth, I guess. And they were getting along so well, I asked this friend of mine who's a photographer to just take them out and do a day of shoots, and she got like 200 pictures of them walking through the park and sitting and talking, and they're all just sort of this kind of relational images. And I think the look she's giving him is a very powerful look. It's definitely a girl who's healing. So I have this little paragraph here. It's the conscious awareness of the wound that eventually ushers the sibling into his or her individuation process. In another very strong brother-sister bond, the brother was called away on his own path when his sister was still quite young. Her wound was great and remained almost entirely unconscious until she reached the age that her brother had been when they separated. Then it became clear that her call to individuation was still linked to his, and she had to work through this loss and separation in order to become a healthy young woman. So that's just the little statement about their relationship. So I'm going to try to round up here. There are a couple of ideas that I haven't really named to, well, actually just one of them that I haven't really named to you that I want to mention to you before I close. And that is an energy that I think I gave a name to it, an energy that I think the brother-sister connection in our psyches gives us a better sense of. And I named this originally, I worked on this theme for many, many years. The original name was the Crusading Spirit. By the time I was publishing the book, my publisher told me I couldn't use that word because a lot of things had happened in the culture that made the term crusade not a positive one. So my original sense of that word was used in a positive sense. So I struggled around trying to find a word that would suffice and that would express this energy. And what I came to was questing. So the questing spirit. It's really one expression of the spirit of the self. And the quest takes on, for a male and a female, it takes on slightly different forms. When I showed you the picture from the Laidly Worm of Spindleston's Hue, the brother who comes back and has to kiss the dragon, that's an experience that I call the quester's return. And the return is very important for the brother. The return to the sister, internally and externally. A return which is really an expression of love. So that the quest becomes a whole experience when a return and a loving connection can be maintained. For the sister, I talk about the sister who is essentially a brother's sister. That aspect of the questing spirit is an aspect that allows her, it's a creative energy, it's a very creative, positive, outward manifestation of that union, and it allows that figure, and this is for the sister or the brother, but it's a powerful thing for a sister to be able to do this. It carries her through very difficult situations in life, dangerous experiences perhaps, And it pushes her to express something like the essence of truth. Now, these are big words I'm using. If you remember that really the experience of the self is an experience of truth. It's an experience of wholeness and unity in the world, in the psyche and in the world. So this particular manifestation of the self pushes the brother's sister or the sister's brother to express that truth in whatever experiences they may encounter. And there's a story that I am not going to talk about much now, but I'll mention it. Some of you may know the story. It's an English fairy tale called Mr. Fox. Anyone know Mr. Fox? He's a Bluebeard type figure. Mr. Fox is. And actually, if you look at Bluebeard and some of the other Bluebeard type stories, you'll find that often there's a brother. In Mr. Fox, there are four brothers that the heroine lives with. In Bluebeard, I think there's one brother. There might be two brothers. I don't remember exactly, but the brother comes and actually kills Bluebeard when he returns for the sister. She calls on her brother, and the brother comes. And there are a couple of other Bluebeard cycle-type stories in which there's a brother who comes to the sister's aid once she's found the truth. And in Mr. Fox, the truth that the sister uncovers is the same kind of truth that there has been victim after victim after victim who's been killed by Mr. Fox. She could have become another victim. Her curiosity led her to uncover the truth. And then with the assistance of her brothers, she waits until her brothers are with her to bring this out to the community. So it's a slightly different scene from the way the end occurs in Bluebeard. She tells the story, and she tells the story as though it were a dream. And Mr. Fox is listening to the story. And in the end, she reveals that she knows that he's a murderer. And the brothers and the other people from the community take him. And, they kill him. I mean, that's what always happens to Bluebeard. But the sister has been able to go into this dangerous place and bring out this truth. And so that's a really powerful depiction of this kind of energy. There's a lot more to it. I'm not going to be able to cover it anymore. So let me just make a little closing remark here. I haven't talked much about the brother-sister dynamic in the culture, so I'm going to touch on it here. So I want to more or less leave you with this idea. This phenomenon of the brother-sister relationship has collective as well as individual significance. We in this country have in our heritage the theme of struggle for equality. It's ongoing. We're not alone, but it's a powerful theme in our culture. Equality, liberty, justice, these are terms that we use often, and I would say we feel them seldom. We're either above or below in most of our interactions with others. There are hierarchical relationships that are much more common than companionship. The brother-sister relationship is about equality. It's about companionship. It's not about competition. Competition may be an important aspect of our psychological life and our development. Brother-sister relationship is not about that. It's about the family of humankind. The competition that we call sibling rivalry, I mentioned that earlier, it's not so much inherent between siblings as it is part of what happens when siblings have to vie for parental attention, parental favor. It's part of development, but it frequently cloaks the potential of the brother-sister connection itself. We often don't get to that potential until later in life. Perhaps the potential seems like an ideal, but in this case, the ideal is not unattainable. We all have to begin by seeing that this potential, like the self, and in fact, it is an aspect of the self, is within each one of us. To turn one's analytic gaze towards the inner energy of the brother-sister pair is to begin an active and a hopeful work that ultimately brings us closer to each other as brothers and sisters breaking bread together. Thank you.
And that is the end of the tape. Copyright C.G. Jung Society, Seattle, and the speaker. All rights reserved. No copying, please.